Let's turn in our Bibles to Acts 7, part 2, title of our study, A Righteous Witness. For those who may not have been with us last time, we are working our way through the book of Acts, and we've come to a part where a guy named Stephen is standing trial for preaching and teaching that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, that he died for our sins, was buried, and rose again. And he's standing trial before the very same people who tried and condemned Jesus. The very same people who Peter and John stood before, and then the other disciples who were threatened and beaten and told not to preach or teach in the name of Jesus. So Stephen is brought there. Some false accusations are made against him, and he's given an opportunity to share. Well, first of all, is he guilty or not guilty? And rather than getting into that issue, he just launches in to this, well, it's a history of the children of Israel all the way from Abraham to, well, it just goes on and on and on until he brings them all the way to Jesus. And so we're in the second part of his testimony. We looked last time at Abraham, and we're looking this time at Joseph. Next time we'll look at Moses. He did all this in just a few minutes, but of course that's not going to happen with us. One of the reasons we're going to spend the time we are, though, is because what he's doing is he's hitting mountaintop experiences in the life of Joseph. He's just saying Joseph was here, and then Joseph was here, and then Joseph was here. What we want to do is get down into the valleys, because that's where we live, literally, in the valley, not at the beach, not on the mountaintop, in the valley. And we're going to see that life in the valley for Joseph, very much like life in the valley for many of us. Well, look at verse 9, Acts 7. The patriarchs, becoming envious, sold Joseph into Egypt. But God was with him and delivered him out of all his troubles and gave him favor and wisdom in the presence of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And he made him governor over Egypt and all his house. He says in two sentences what took more than a decade to take place. And you can imagine some other things happen besides sold and pleased and delivered and made governor. Well, that's what we're going to look at today. A famine and great trouble arose over the land of Egypt and Canaan, and our fathers found no sustenance. But when Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he sent out our fathers first. And the second time Joseph was made known to his brothers, and Joseph's family became known to the Pharaoh. Then Joseph sent and called his father Jacob and all his relatives to him, 75 people. So Jacob went down to Egypt, and he died, he and our fathers, and they were carried back to Shechem and laid in the tomb that Abraham bought for a sum of money from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem. Well, while there are many Old Testament saints who demonstrate Christ-like attributes and character, there is no one more like Jesus in the Old Testament than Joseph. Arthur Pink found 100 parallels between the life of Joseph and the life of Jesus, and he didn't have to do any stretching. They were both shepherds. Well, Joseph literally, Jesus figuratively, the good shepherd, the great shepherd, the chief shepherd. And we'll look at a few of the parallels as they would relate to the story and really some practical application for us. Well, what we read here in verse 9 is that the patriarchs became envious. We'll talk about why. We'll actually look at the story in a moment. But I want you to see that there is a direct parallel between what was taking place there in the story and what was taking place as Stephen stood before these religious leaders. Remember, these are the same guys that sent Jesus to his death. And they did it in part for the same reason. Pilate could see it. He knew that they had handed Jesus over because of envy, we read. Yeah, they were troubled that the crowds had gone from John the Baptist, and that bothered them in the first place, but now they were going to Jesus, and really they weren't as interested in, well, what they had to say and what they were doing, and But it wasn't just envy, it was hatred. That was the problem between Joseph and his family. That was the problem between Jesus and the religious leaders of his day. Well, why did Joseph's brothers envy him? I want you to go back to Genesis 37 with me. This is what we did last time. What we'll do this time, next time, it'll be a part of the book of Exodus. And then we'll be just tracking through Acts for the next few weeks. We won't be going back and forth or spending most of our time in the Old Testament. Again, he's hitting the mountaintops. We're going to go down into the valleys. We're going to see the things that happened in between these major events that Stephen draws our attention to. Our first clue as to why Joseph's brothers hated and envied him is given to us in verses 3 and 4 of Genesis 37, where we read, "Now Israel," that's Jacob, he's known by both names, why he is the father of the 12 sons who become the leaders of the 12 tribes of Israel. So Israel loved Joseph more than all his children. That's an issue. Also, a little later in the verse, it said he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Joseph was loved by his father, and for good reason. He came late or much later in his life. And he was a son that just pleased his father. No doubt, even as Jesus, and you should be aware, Jesus was able to say something none of us can say. Well, we could say it, but it wouldn't be true of us. He said, "I do always those things that please the Father." I like to be able to say at the end of the day, I did all day only those things that pleased the Father. Every thought, every word, pleasing to Him and glorifying to Him. But the reality is only Jesus could say such a thing and have it be true. Why? All of us have sinned and do sin and will sin. That's not to excuse it. It's just a recognition of that reality. If not in deed, in thought. If not in word, in thought. And if you've gotten to the place where you can fully control every thought, so nothing evil ever comes to mind or nothing evil ever comes out of your mouth, well, then you're a perfect man and you should be in heaven. Because only perfect, that's the only place there are any perfect men, you see. Well, in any case, that will happen someday. We'll stand before Him. We'll be with Him. We will be like Him. I mentioned that Pilate knew it was for envy and hatred that Jesus was handed over. Joseph's brothers had another plan altogether. They hate him and they couldn't speak peaceably of him. And then things are complicated by the fact that he's a bit of a dreamer. In fact, well, we read in verse 5, Joseph had a dream and he told it to his brothers and they hated him even more. Well, why? His dream was that his sheaves were out in the field and their sheaves, and sheaves are just the, you know, they gather the wheat and then they would bind it together. So he said that we were binding sheaves and my sheaf was there and your sheaves were there and your sheaves all bowed down to my sheaves. Now, this whole family has the gift of interpretation. There's not once they say, well, what could that mean? They're like, are you kidding me? And I mean, not literally, but they say something very similar, as verse 8 says, shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us? They knew exactly what the dream meant. Now understand, he just dreamed it. It wasn't his fault. That's just what he dreamed. He said, hey, I had this weird dream. Want to hear it? I'm pretty sure after this one, they're like, no, thanks. But he has another dream. And in this dream, well, where is it here in verse 8, verse 9? The sun, the moon, the 11 stars bowed down to him. Again, no one asked for an explanation. This time his father takes charge, though. Verse 10 says he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream that you've dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come and bow down to the earth before you? And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. He got it, you see, Dad. He's like, what, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars? Well, yeah, that's because there would be 11 of them who ultimately would bow down before him. The sun represents Dad, the moon represents Mom. And by the way, this becomes very important when you get into the book of Revelation. There is a picture very similar to this. Commentators argue about, well, who's it representing and who's it pointing to and what's it all mean? It all comes out of Genesis. It's explained for us back here. So if you, like so many, read the book of Revelation and say, I just don't get it. Here's a tip. Read from Genesis to Malachi. I realize that's a big assignment. But if you realize it's only 39 books, you don't have to read them all in a day. Just pick a book a week. In 39 weeks, you'll have completed the task. If you read the Old Testament and you're familiar with it, the book of Revelation will be much simpler and clearer for you. Why? Most of the imagery that's not explained comes straight out of the Old Testament. And then the imagery that is explained, well, you don't have a problem with it because it's explained for you. Well, he has a dream and his brothers don't like it. He has a dream and his father rebukes him. His brothers envy him, but his father kept the matter in mind. It reminds me of Jesus in a couple of ways. Remember, Jesus, like Joseph, knew the future. There's a different reason for it. God was revealing the future to Joseph. Jesus knew the future because Jesus is God the Son and the Son of God. And even Pilate could recognize that these religious leaders envy Jesus, Jesus in Matthew 24 and 5 basically gives us an outline of history in advance. Don't turn to it now, but make a mental note or jot it down. Matthew 24, that is what's coming. Matthew, some of it has taken place, destruction of the temple, 70 AD, some of those things, but the majority of things Jesus speaks of in that particular chapter are actually fleshed out for us in the book of Revelation, chapter 6 through 19, including the return of our Lord and Savior to establish his kingdom upon the earth. Now, as Jesus was standing before his accusers, the high priest put him under oath, saying, "Tell us plainly if you are the Christ, the Son of God." Interesting. The very same thing that Peter had said, well, this is who you are. And Jesus had affirmed it and said, it's a revelation from heaven. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. So when the high priest says, tell us plainly if that's who you are, what do you think Jesus is going to say? He says, of course, it's as you have said. Nevertheless, hereafter you'll see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. What was their response to this? The high priest tore his clothes. He called it blasphemy. The people said he's worthy of death. And so Joseph dreams and he shares his dreams and his brothers decide, we're going to kill this guy. We'll see what becomes of this dreamer. And the very same thing happens to Jesus. He just tells the truth. He tells them what's coming. He tells them who he is. Here's what's going to happen. And they call it blasphemy. And they send him to his death. Now in Genesis 37, verse 20, Joseph's brothers see him coming. They're out tending the sheep. They've traveled a bit. And the father sends Joseph to come and see what's up with those guys. And as they approach, or excuse me, as he approaches, they say, let us kill him and cast him in some pit. And we shall say some wild beast has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. Now, they actually planned to leave him in the pit until he died. And then one of them got an idea. Hey, what profit is there in killing our brother? Let's sell him. And if you've been in a family where there were multiple siblings, you kind of understand this. I'm not saying it's justified at all. But if you grew up in a less than perfect home or environment, and listen, I'm not saying that's the case for most or all, certainly not. In fact, lest I forget it, If you have been raised by godly parents who've loved you and loved the Lord and taught you and been an example to you, before this day ends, you should make sure you thank them. If they live on the East Coast, call them up. If they live locally, go see them in person. But let them know. Because I want to tell you, the dysfunctional family that Joseph grew up in, and the dysfunctional family that Jesus came to, he came into his own, but his own received him not. But as many as received him, he gave power to become the sons of God, even to those who believed on his name. Listen, those families, they rival any family problems we might have had. In fact, I would suggest if things have been less than perfect in your upbringing, well, read through Joseph's entire life story. You're going to say, well, I guess it could have been worse, Lord, because I can't imagine whatever your brothers did to torment you. I was the oldest brother, so I did most of the tormenting. But, you know, I was a really good kid, so there was very little of that, of course. But if you grew up in a family with multiple brothers and sisters or multiple siblings, you know there are some things that happen that, well, if you had control, it wouldn't have happened. Joseph's brothers put him in a pit. They were going to let him die, and then one says, hey, let's sell him. And they're like, great idea. Let's do it. And they sell him for 20 pieces of silver. Now, this is important because Jesus will later be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. It's a sign of inflation, by the way. Back in Joseph's day, a slave sold for 20 pieces of silver. In Jesus' day, a slave sold for 30 pieces of silver. But not to make light of a serious situation. They sell him and he's taken down to Egypt where he's sold again. So the guys that buy him, they're just middlemen. They take him and they sell him to a guy named Potiphar. Now, I mentioned that Joseph was pleasing to his father and that Jesus was always pleasing to his father. He was able, as I shared, to say, I do always those things that please the Father. And there was testimony given to both realities. The Father said at Jesus' baptism, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. Someone asked me after first service, or right before it, because he was here last night, actually, one of the Sunday school teachers, do you think that everyone heard that, or was it just said for Jesus' sake? And I think everyone heard it, because he didn't say, you are my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. He said, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. Yeah, he could have just spoken to the Son, but they were in constant communion and communication. No, it was for the sake of the others. And we know on the Mount of Transfiguration, he says the same thing. This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. Peter, John, James, hey, they got that and they share it. We heard him speak when we were on the Holy Mount. Well, in any case, Joseph pleased his father. Jesus pleased his father, but you can't please everybody. And Jesus was hated by the religious leaders of his day. That's the parallel Stephen's drawing, because Joseph was hated by the forefathers of those religious leaders that crucified Jesus. Now we read something of Joseph, and I want you to see this because it becomes the key to his survival and his success. It's in Genesis 39, so we're making a little progress. We're actually going to get all the way to 50, but we're going to skip most of it in order to do it. In Genesis 39, verse 2, we read, the Lord was with Joseph. I love that sound, by the way. Bible pages turning. It's my favorite sound in the whole world, I have to be honest. Well, maybe my grandson's starting to, you know, catch up with that. But Genesis 39:2, the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian, and his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. That's exactly what Stephen testified to. But remember, he just went from, you know, he was sold and he was, you know, pleasing and everybody could see that God was with him. So here's the secret of his success. Now, we talked a little bit about family, very briefly. Now let's move to the workplace, since most of you work. And if you don't, you will. lots of us have worked, or many of you are working, in a less than desirable workplace. If you think, well, you wouldn't know what that's like. Oh, I really do. I played music in the bars for 8 years as the social director of the Alcoholics Club. And so it's, you know, when you're doing that for a living and you're young, you think everyone's there to see you. Later, you find out it's not about you at all. And so anyway, I was in those bars, and when I became a Christian, I was in a band with some of the biggest idiots you could ever meet. And no, I still dearly love them, but hey, they'll admit they're idiots at this point. And the bottom line is, I know what it is to go to work, and I know what it is to hear the stories, and I know some of you, you go to work on Monday morning, and there's the posters, and there's... Although that's becoming less politically correct, and I'm grateful for it. That's one of the only things about political correctness that might be good, is that, you know, some of that stuff is going away. But I know some of you are thinking, not in my workplace, it's not. It's still there. Or the guys have the stories, you know, about their weekend conquest, how much they drank, how much they threw up, the gal they met, but can't even remember what she looks like. You know, all those wonderful stories. And if you're working or living in that kind of a scene, let me just say, Joseph's situation wasn't much better. But here's how Joseph survived it and why he was able to thrive in the midst of it. We read two things. The Lord was with Joseph. And you need to know that's true for you as well. Wherever you are, whatever you're going through, at home, at work, at play, at school, since not everyone works yet, some of you are in school. Listen, the Lord is with you. Not only with you, but for you. And then there's more. It said he was successful, and not only was he successful, but the guy he was working for, and he wasn't just a hired hand. Remember, he's a slave. Used to be the father's favorite. Now he's a slave in the house of a military guy. And that military guy realizes, hey, whatever this guy puts his hands to prospers. He realizes that having Joseph around, that's a real good thing. So you need to see it. I've seen it. Joseph was faithful to serve right where God had him. And Potiphar was being blessed for his sake. And so you would think, okay, things are going as good as they could given the situation. But the trials are only beginning. What happens next? Potiphar's wife begins to look at Joseph with longing eyes. And then she actually comes on to him and she says, come and lie with me. Now, his response to all of this, well, it's a biblical response. Look at Genesis 39:9, the latter part of verse 9, where Joseph says, how can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? First, he says, hey, everything in the house is under my control. Your husband's given me everything, and I, the only thing he keeps from me is you because you're his wife. So how could I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Listen, when was the last time you heard anyone call fornication or adultery this great wickedness or a sin against God? No, my generation, it was a fling, or it was a thing, or it was, you know, they had songs to celebrate it. It's horrific that we would take what God calls an abomination, what he says defiles the individual and devastates and destroys relationships and families, and call it just a thing or just a fling. I got to tell you, the younger generation is more honest than our generation was, although just as confused. They'll say, it's just sex. They got the three letters right, but they need to get the other three, and that's S-I-N. That's what he called it, you see. It's not just sex, it's sin. It's not just sex, it is great wickedness. And so not only does he tell her that this isn't going to happen, when she continues to press him, he runs away. Now listen, here's a story you're never going to hear on Monday morning at work or at school. Yeah, this babe came on to me, you know, I was at this party and she came on and they're like, yeah, and what happened next? It's like, I ran out of there, man. I hightailed out. I got away clean. You what? They would think you're crazy. But I would say, well done, good and faithful servant. Flee youthful lust. And in case you're not so young, flee old guy lust. Or if it's an issue with gals, flee your stuff too. But the deal is, Joseph did what, well, God would have anyone right thinking and right representing do. He said, this isn't going to happen. And you would think at this point there would be some great reward that the Lord would say, and I'm sure he's saying, well done. But she's not done, you see. Because he refuses her advances, because he runs out on her, she says that he tried to rape her. Now, I don't believe for a moment her husband believed it. But he had to deal with Joseph and do something. Here's why I don't think he believed it. He's a military guy. He's a captain. He's got all these guys under him. If his wife was assaulted by one of his slaves, that guy's not making it out of there alive. I guarantee it. Not in that generation, not even in this generation. And so what happens is he's put into prison. Here's his reward for doing the right thing. Now, here's the crazy part. He's falsely accused and then put into prison. Hey, isn't this what happened to Jesus? He's arrested, he's falsely accused, he's tried, and then he's crucified. Well, and so here's what happens with Joseph and how it applies to us. Doing the right thing does not mean that things are going to go our way. But here's what you carry with you if you do the right thing. You have a clear conscience. And never underestimate the value of a clear conscience. To be able to say, I know that Lord, the Lord strengthened me and he showed me the way out. He always makes a way of escape. He promises to. But the bottom line is, Joseph still ended up in prison. Though he had only sinned by being loved by his father, and that wasn't his fault. It wasn't really his sin. It was his brother's sin that put him in the pit, that sold him into slavery. And now this woman's sin who falsely accuses him, and he finds himself in prison. They're in the prison. Well, it's dream time. And a couple guys who worked for the Pharaoh, a butler and a baker, they have some dreams, and Joseph's like, I know what's up with that. And he says, by the way, only God really can interpret these things. And so he gives the butler an explanation of his dream. And for time's sake, listen, you go back and read the whole thing later. I hope, if nothing else, you'll grab hold of two or three main things to chew on and dwell on. And then you'll go and read the whole story so God can just flood you with great and glorious application from this life story. But the issue is that the butler tells him his dream and he says, well, here's the interpretation, but interpretations only come from God. He's quick to give God the glory. And then the baker, hearing, hey, that worked out pretty good for him, he tells him his dream and he goes, well, it's not such good news for you. Turns out that things go just as Joseph said they were. And Joseph has just one request. He says, hey, by the way, when you get up there, would you remember me? Would you mention I'm innocent and I'm down here in prison? But 2 years go by. I don't know how long Joseph had been in the house of Potiphar, or how long he was on the way to Egypt. They walked, you know. But I do know this. He was a teen when it all started, and he'll be about 30 when he stands before Pharaoh. And so this was a long, difficult trial for somebody made of the same stuff as us, who was doing the right thing in spite of everyone else seemingly doing the wrong thing. Look at Genesis 39, 21. It brings up the next major issue, and you're going to say, well, this is the same issue. Yeah, I know. But I want you to see it's true in every context for him. Now he's in prison, and it says, the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy. And he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison, who in verse 22 committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. In verse 23, it says the keeper of the prison didn't look into anything that was under Joseph's authority because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. Do you see that this theme developing? Hey, he was with him, the Lord that is, even in the pit. Though it doesn't have to tell us that. He was with him in the house of Potiphar. He's with him in the prison. Now he's the trustee of the prison. And he's doing such a good job, the prison keeper, the one responsible for him and the other prisoners, just says, hey, you take care of it. And he can kick back. And everything is going better in the prison because Joseph's in the prison. Well, ultimately, Pharaoh has a couple dreams, and this is how he goes from the pit to the house of Potiphar to the prison and ultimately to the palace, where we will find God is with him even in the palace. But Pharaoh has a couple dreams, and his dreams are a little strange. He sees these really fat cows, and then he's got some really skinny cows in the dream. And I've had a couple of dreams like that. You know, you go to bed late, you eat cereal or something, you dream of steaks, you know. And so he's got the fat cows, and he's got the skinny cows, not the ice cream, literally skinny cows. And it says that the skinny cows ate up the fat cows. That was disturbing. And then he also had some grain, and some was beautiful grain, and then there was blighted grain, and the blighted grain ate up the beautiful grain. And so he's struggling with this dream or these dreams, and he's troubled over them, and he makes mention of it, and the butler's like, oh yeah, it's 2 years later. Oh yeah. There's this guy Joseph. I was supposed to mention him to you. And by the way, he can interpret dreams. So Joseph goes from being in prison one day to standing before Pharaoh in the palace the next. But it gets better than that. He says, listen, God has shown you. In fact, he says it again and again. God has shown you what he is about to do. Look at verse 28 here in Genesis 41. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. The dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice because the thing is established by God. Oh, excuse me, that's verse 32. Had to skip ahead. And God will shortly bring it to pass. So what's he saying? Hey, God knows the future and God controls the future. That's exactly how God says we can know who he is. He knows the future and he reveals it and then he causes it to come to pass exactly as he's revealed it. And so he's saying, if you want the theological terms, God's omniscient. He knows all things. He's omnipotent. He can do all things. And so he says, and God's shown you because he's going to make this happen soon. And then this guy who just yesterday was in prison and now is standing before Pharaoh starts to counsel him. He says in verse 33 of chapter 41, now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. I love this. He's saying, here's what I'd do if I were you. And Pharaoh's not that dumb, you see. He thinks, who's brighter than this guy? Who knows more than this guy? He takes Joseph, who's gone through all of this trial, at least a decade of it. And in a day, in a moment, he exalts him. It says he makes him governor. But as you read on, you find out that the governor in Egypt, not like the governor of California. No, this guy is second in command in the entire nation. Everyone has to bow down to him. Everyone has to listen to him. And so Joseph sets out to make preparation. He knows a famine is coming. So during the 7 good years, he's putting lots of grain aside. And then during the 7 years of famine, they will have all they need to survive. That's what Stephen said happened, that he set the whole thing up. God was working through Joseph the entire time. Now, the one thing we'll never know this side of heaven is why God does things this way. I mean, couldn't he have just brought Joseph to Pharaoh and said, hey, here's your guy? But apparently, God's ways aren't our ways, and he does say so. And I found that to be absolutely true. Well, what we do know is a great famine came over the land. And in Genesis 42:6, We read Joseph was governor over the land. It was he who sold all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth. Genesis 42:6. We'll see what will become of this dreamer and his dreams. Now check this out. They don't recognize him because he's really changed. He walks and talks. Dresses like an Egyptian. The Hebrews, they got big beards. The Egyptians, they're clean shaven. And remember, Joseph was just a teen when they sold him. Now he's probably around 30 or so. And so he recognizes them. It says so here in Genesis 42:7. He saw his brothers. He recognized them, but acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Now, just like Jesus tells us to, Joseph not only forgives his brothers, though they don't realize he's forgiven them because they don't even know he's Joseph, but he provides for their every need during this time of famine. He does a couple things that are a little bit strange, and I hope you read the story later, and if you've ever played practical jokes on your family, he does at least one pretty interesting practical joke. All that ends up leading the entire family ultimately down into Egypt, where they need to be, because there's only 75 of them. Remember the promise to Abraham, and years go by and a decade goes by and 24 years goes by, but the promised seed, Isaac, was not yet born. And then, well, we kind of closed his life with Isaac being born, and then Jacob comes on the scene, and by the end of Jacob's life, there's 75 of them. But there will be just a multitude. These guys are going to just grow and amazing and increasing numbers, and it will bridge. This end of this story bridges us into, well, what Stephen will be sharing next time as we look at the life of Moses. But a couple other things to consider right here in our passage. We don't have to go back to Acts. You can read through that entire story, chapter 7. And you should read through, well, from 37 all the way to the end of this entire story. But what happens is, after Jacob brings the family down, and ultimately after his death, and they take his bones at his request, well, his burial, it's not just his bones, but they take him back to be buried back in the land. He doesn't want to be buried in Egypt, and we get that, the resurrection. He wants to be there in Israel. And so what happens is, after he dies, the boys get together and they say, hey, he's going to kill us, you know. He's probably just spared us because of Dad. And so they actually send a message to him. For this one, we got to jump all the way over to chapter 50, and I apologize for that. But, I mean, I could actually tell you the whole story, but not get rid of you for the third service people. And I shouldn't say get rid of, but, hey, that is a harsh reality of what's going to happen. And so you can stay up. You just can't stay here. And so as we used to say elsewhere. Well, Genesis 50, around verse 15, you know, Jacob dies, the boys fear. They confess, by the way, and they send a message to him, say, hey, Dad wanted you to forgive us, and we want you to forgive us. And so verse 19 is where we'll pick up, Genesis 50, verse 19, where he says to them, do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. See how important this is. He's not saying, hey, I know you guys didn't know what you were doing. No, they knew what they were doing, and they were doing evil. And their intention was to do evil. And he says so, you meant it for evil. But God is so together that he can even take man's sin and bring about his good, his plan, his purpose. And that's what he said happened. You meant evil, but God meant it for good. In order to bring it about as it is to this day, to save many people alive. Now, therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Now, listen. Jesus has instructed us to do exactly what Joseph did for them. To forgive, to bless, to pray for, to do good to. And we not only have the command, we have, well, the example of men like Joseph who did it. And remember, Joseph was a man just like us. We have the example of Jesus who from the cross itself prayed, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they do." It's not to say he excuses what they did or they're just automatically off the hook. No. If we confess our sin, he's faithful and just to forgive us and cleanse us of all unrighteousness. That's the testimony. So whatever it is, the thought, the word, the action, the attitude, God looks on the heart. And today, it's the day of reconciliation. It's the day of redemption. If you know the Lord and he's put his finger on something in your life and it's like maybe the first time or maybe the 5,000th time, and he's like, "I've been talking to you about this every time." And so just confess it to him and turn from it. Let him cleanse you and forgive you and start things with a clear conscience. He not only forgives and cleanses, he gives us a clear conscience. Not that we haven't done anything, but we know we have a fresh start with him. And if you've never given your life to him, do it today. Lord, thank you.